This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bean Cooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, in for Terry Gross. Our first guest, Amy Schumer, has a Comedy Central series Inside Amy Schumer that is ending Tuesday, but only for the season. It's already been renewed for season two. Her show is a mix of stand-up, short sketches, and interviews. She plays a lot of different characters in the sketches, but her persona in stand-up comedy is an attractive, middle-class, educated single woman who's a little slutty. As her executive producer Dan Powell put it, she can say the most filthy, obscene things in the sweetest manner. Last year, she had a special on Comedy Central called Mostly Sex Stuff, which was the second highest rated special on the network in 5 years. You may have seen her roasting celebrities like Roseanne Barr and Charlie Sheen. Mel Brooks recently described her on our show as a new comic he thinks is wonderful. Amy Schumer will not sweetly be saying obscene things on our show, but we are going to hear an adult conversation about her comedy, and there may be some punchlines you won't want to explain to young children. Terry spoke with Schumer last Tuesday and began with an excerpt of her stand-up comedy act from the first episode of Inside Amy Schumer.
I'm a little sluttier than the average bear. I really am a little sluttier. I can be honest about that. Like, I'm no stranger to Plan B, I'll say that. I'm not like, what is that? Like, I know what it is. It's the morning after pill. You can take it the night before if you're feeling amped, you know? Just like walk by a mirror, catch a glimpse of yourself in a new tube top, like, whoa, pop, you can do that. You feel like such a dirty whore buying Plan B. It is so embarrassing. Because it's over the counter, but you have to ask your pharmacist. And they know what you want, but they make you ask. They're looking at me, I'm like, you see where my eyeliner is, just give it to me. The staring contest. What do you think, I'm here because it's allergy season, really?
That's Amy Schumer from her show Inside Amy Schumer. Amy Schumer, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you for having me.
My sense of responsibility as a journalist requires me to say, you really can't take Plan B the night before.
So, yes.
I want to make sure everybody knows that that's a joke and that they don't try that. So
it didn't even occur to me that someone would take that as actual advice. Wow, I should really have more ownership over that. But I like that that was one of the cleaner clips that you found to play.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. So I just have to ask you, do you really think of yourself as a slut?
I often wonder how attractive I am and how slutty I am. That's something I'm back and forth on. But I think I have been promiscuous, and I think a lot of women have, so I like to talk about it as a way to maybe make those other women feel less alone and less strange and dirty about their own actions.
Tell us more how that became your comic persona.
That wasn't on purpose. I started out very much set up punchline. And I think, you know, I started when I was 22 or 23 years old. So I've always been sexual. I've always been a sexual girl. But it was coming out more and more in my stand-up. So it wasn't a conscious decision. But then I was getting ready to film my hour special for Comedy Central. And they said, you know, it's a lot of stuff about sex. Can you maybe mix it up more? Maybe some racism or something else. And I said, why don't we just call it Mostly Sex Stuff? And so it was kind of like a lazy decision. And that was really when I realized, wow, it is a lot of stuff about sex. But I didn't grow up hearing any women really delving into that side of themselves. And so I thought, maybe I can be this person for women and for men, just to hear the woman's perspective in a less apologetic, honest way. And I don't know if I'm going to veer away from that or what, but I've been trying to keep it pretty natural, just stuff I'm interested in talking about.
So a lot of male comics talk about sex a lot on stage,
yeah.
More than your average female comic does. What did you take from that male approach to sex comedy, and what did you reject from it?
I don't know that I could really generalize a male approach to comedy and sex, but I do know that I'll get off stage and the club owner will be like, that was a lot about sex. And they would never say that to a male comic. Dave Attell or Jim Norton would never get off stage and have a promoter of a theater or a club go over like, you like to talk about sex, you know? So it's just that it was made such a... there's such a stigma with being a woman who talks about sex, and there's just sort of no repercussions, I think, if you're a male comic that talks about sex. They wouldn't label you that way, I don't think.
So you do some interviews in your shows, and in one set of interviews, you're interviewing people on the street about whether they sexed or not, and whether they like being sexted. And do you ever do that?
Do I sext?
Uh-huh.
Do you mean have I ever sent like a sexual message to somebody over text?
Yes, or picture of yourself?
Yeah, definitely. Now that I'm more well-known, I can't put my head in them. but no, I don't. I've definitely over the years, yeah, I've been in long-distance relationships, and it's definitely happened. Yeah, I have definitely engaged in sext messaging. What about you?
Who, me?
Sorry, I couldn't help myself.
So one of your sketches ends with, I forget whether you're sexting or what, but it ends with you turning on the end of like an old black and white, like 1930s or 1940s movie where like the romantic finale is the kiss.
and
it's so,
right.
It's so chaste and romantic compared to all the sexting and everything. And do you think that that's the kind of split that you sometimes have in your own life of like doing all this like explicit stuff, but loving like the romantic fantasies of, say, old 1940s movies?
Yeah, I think so. And the scene where I'm sexting, I'm sitting there and a guy doesn't know where he's catching you. He's like, what are you wearing? And I'm sitting there and I'm wearing a t-shirt with a cat on it, wearing a bonnet that says Downton Caddy. And I'm eating pasta with my hands. And so I wrote that scene and I thought, what if I wrote back what I was actually thinking, which is, you know, he's like, what do you want me to do to you? And I'm like, tell me I'm safe in my apartment. Tell me what all the remotes do. And then also trying to navigate, what does this guy want me to say? And just sort of, you know, like just, I don't know. And, but yeah, like just that girls, I still do want that romance and to be adored by someone. But then there's also this high demand to be super sexual. And that's being asked, I think, of a lot of women more and more now. I'm assuming with the younger generation, the sort of sexual demands are so much higher now. And so I think that scene is just showing a real girl just trying to navigate this new territory.
So there's another sketch I want to play. And this is a real girl thing. It's a sketch about how girls handle compliments from other girls. And and this sketch starts with two girlfriends running into each other on the street. And Amy Schumer enters the scene a little bit later.
Oh my God, Brit, you dyed your hair. It looks amazing.
Oh no, you're just being nice.
No, seriously, it looks great.
No, I tried to look like Kate Hudson, but ended up looking like a golden retriever's dingleberry.
But you, look at your cute little dress.
Little, I'm like a size 100 now. Anyway, I paid like $2 for it. It's probably made out of old Burger King crowns. I look like a whore locked out of her apartment.
Hi.
Amy.
Hi.
I love your hat.
Are you drunk? I look like an Armenian man. People are trying to buy carpets from me.
Excuse me, when did you start working for NASA? You're weightless.
You, I'm a cow. Indian people are trying to worship me. I sleep standing up in a field.
Fancy meeting you girls here.
Of course, I see everyone when I look like Susan Boyle's toothbrush.
Ew.
Looks so pretty.
Miss Jessica, congrats on your big promotion, biatch.
I'm gonna get fired in like 2 seconds.
No.
I'm legally retarded. On my SATs, I just drew a picture of a house on the first page and ate the rest.
Lindsay!
That's a sketch from Inside Amy Schumer, and Amy Schumer is my guest. I recognize that. I really do.
Oh, good.
That sense of like if somebody says something nice to you, that you have to somehow answer it with a self-insult, you know, with something like really
I think
self-derogatory.
A lot of,
why is that? What is that about?
I have some ideas. I think it might be because we're afraid of jealousy from other women, or it might be from actual self-hatred. But I know that every girl I know does that. But I think that scene, it went viral, you know, whatever that means. A lot of people watched it and responded to it, especially women, of course. And they everybody just recognized that behavior in themselves. And I think it has affected the women that have seen it. It's affected me, because you catch yourself doing that. We just noticed we were doing it around the writer's office, and to a ridiculous degree. We just thought, let's shine a light on this. And we do that as much as possible on the show. But I'm glad that that one resonated with people.
So this was women in the writer's office doing that?
Every scene wound up being a big collaboration. But yeah, it was the women in the office doing it. The men, I've never noticed men doing that. I'll be like, that's a great shirt. And then the guy will just wear that shirt all week.
Another sketch I want to play from your show. And this is about the difficulty of dealing with older members of your family who blurt out racist things and don't even get why it's racist, why it's like so wrong to say that. And in this scene, like, you and your boyfriend, who's Latino, are at dinner with your family, including your grandmother. And here's the scene, and this is from Inside Amy Schumer.
All of our friends had left us, and we were both stuck there. I mean, Napa Valley of all places, but that's basically how Carlos and I met.
I am very happy to meet you. Also, I'm finished.
Oh my God, Grandma, no, Carlos is not a busboy. He's my boyfriend. I'm so sorry.
Amy, it's okay. She grew up during a different time.
Tell him to start mowing the lawn by the pool so it'll be quiet for my nap.
Look familiar? Are you tired of your elderly relatives thinking their blatant racism is okay?
I don't know how to help my grandma.
There is an answer. Generations. A revolutionary new facility where we give your elderly loved ones the politically correct social skills to get along in the modern world.
This person is what?
Drug mule.
A gardener?
No. Latino.
That's really funny.
Thank you.
Have you experienced this with relatives or
yes,
or
I
friends?
Wrote this scene, and I've definitely experienced that with relatives. My great-grandma, who was a bootlegger, old New York, she, Estelle Schumer, she passed away a couple years ago, but her liquor store is still up on 54th Street. But she, you know, all New York, she was 90, I think, 4 when she died, or 95, and she would just say a word. She would call black people colored, and it would just make all the blood rush to my head, like, no, that's not okay. But then you think, well, she's so old. And then, you know, I would mention that to my friends, and then I realize everybody has, you know, most people I know have older relatives that will just say something that's so unacceptable. And then I just thought, well, what's the age? What's the cutoff? Because if one of my parents said something inappropriate, I would stop them. So, and it seems like a lot of people have had this experience. And so I had the idea to film this scene.
You've done some very high-profile roasts, like Charlie Sheen and Roseanne Barr, who she really complimented you at the end of that roast.
I know. I started crying.
Oh, seriously?
That was so nice. Yeah, I was so moved by that.
I think that's the first time I heard your name, in fact. You know, I turned in at the end of the roast, and Roseanne Barr sang in that Amy Schumer, she was so funny. And I thought, oh, Amy Schumer, who is? I don't know who that is. Who is that?
Oh, that's awesome. Roseanne plugged me and made you discover me. Yeah, that was such a special moment. And yeah, I was really not expecting that. It's a roast. It's such, you know, everyone's claws are out. And then to get a compliment like that from someone I just grew up loving and thinking was so hilarious.
And from somebody who just had every insult in the books thrown at them in a comedic fashion.
Yeah. I think the comedians really, that's such a place for comedians to shine. We just know that there's no venom, and it's just, we just appreciate each other constructing jokes. And I did my best to be careful. I'm more careful with women at those roasts. I wouldn't want to say anything that would actually offend.
Why are you more careful with women?
there's just more territory that I feel like you can't say certain things to women. I think attacking a woman's appearance is, I just know how wounding that is. And
too much like daily life itself.
yeah, right, exactly. Just too many people just every day will say something, just a backhanded compliment or just a flat-out insult, and maybe they don't even realize that they think it's something that you've accepted, or, you know, and they'll just hand you a new insecurity. And I would not want to be someone to do that. So I definitely, you know, said hard jokes, but I wouldn't say anything about a woman's appearance that I thought might hurt her feelings.
How did you get on the roast circuit, so to speak?
I just had a relationship with Comedy Central, and they know me. They know that I've sort of been trained since birth, I think, to do a roast. I like writing set-up punchlines, and I can be harsh, and they know that about me. But I submitted to write for the Charlie Sheen roast. I just sent in a packet, and then you make it onto the next round, and then they have you write. They make up a fictitious roast. You know, they're okay, we're roasting Kanye West and Jennifer Aniston, for example. And then you write jokes as though you're roasting them, and you submit them. So I made it through a couple rounds, and then I didn't get it. They were like, "You didn't get it," and I was, you know, I was disappointed. And I didn't know that I was in contention to be on the Charlie Sheen roast. And then I found out a couple weeks before that they were thinking about maybe putting me on the dais. And then I found out 2 weeks before that I was going to be on the dais and roasting Charlie Sheen. And so I had those 2 weeks to get myself ready for that.
Have you said anything at a roast that you've regretted?
No. I have not said anything at a roast that I regretted.
You did say one thing about Ryan Dunn from Jackass after he died.
I guess you regret me saying it.
I have no position, and okay. I didn't hear the roast. I just, you know, read about it. But
right.
a lot of people were very offended by what you said, and you've said that you even got death threats afterwards. And
yeah,
and that's kind of scary to think about, that you're at a roast where it's like your job to say really insulting things. But then people could get so angry that they threaten you.
Yeah, that was really surreal. It was, the joke was, I said, Steve-O, one of the Jackass guys, his friend, one of the other Jackass guys, had just died in a drunk driving accident. And so I said, Steve-O, I'm sorry for the loss of your friend Ryan Dunn. I'm sure you must be thinking it could have been me. And I know we were all thinking, why wasn't it? So the joke was sort of I felt like the formula of any roast joke. It's take something that you're not supposed to talk about and then twist that into an insult. And I thought it was very typical and didn't see anything that was too much about that. I'm also used to playing with comics, and just we go after each other so horribly, and I just didn't think that joke was a big deal. I didn't think it was a joke about making fun of somebody who died. I thought it was a joke making fun of Steve O, and then people's reaction to it, I was really surprised, because that joke wasn't a big deal in the room. At the actual roast, there wasn't a huge reaction to it, but the way it was edited, they cut to Steve-O, and he looked so sad, and I'm sure if I saw that, I would have thought, oh gosh, that was too much or something, but the way it happened and his reaction, and, you know, I've spoken to him since, he's a friend, I knew what my intentions were saying that joke, and I never felt like I'd made a mistake, and I've made several mistakes in my life, and I don't think I'm above it, but I don't think that was one of them.
There's a sketch on one of the editions of Inside Amy Schumer that relates to roasts, and I want to play a clip from that. And this is a scene where there's a dying child, a child dying of cancer in a hospital, and his last request, his make-a-wish request, is for you to visit him. So you comply, and you show up in the hospital. he's in bed with, you know, oxygen tubes in his nose and looking very deathly and pale. And his very worried parents are standing by the bedside. You walk in and stand next to him by the bed. And midway through this scene, the boy's doctor walks in, and the boy's doctor starts making jokes. You'll hear that.
Hey, Jason, I'm Amy. I brought this for you.
Oh, your headshot. Okay.
I just want you to know that you're really special, and everything's gonna be fine.
Well, I'm realizing that I bit off a little bit more than I could chew. It was an honor meeting you.
Oh, whoa, where do you think you're going?
I was gonna go get my car.
Don't you know why you're here?
I thought I was just supposed to come and meet Jason. Did I do something wrong?
Roast me!
Roast you?
It was our son's last wish to be roasted by a professional comedian.
Okay. Yeah, I don't feel comfortable making fun of your son.
You think I give a what you are comfortable with?
Okay. Nice why don't you get some more tubes in your nose, weirdo?
Is that even a joke?
Okay. Where's the rest of your hair? Is it the hair parade where there's no hair?
Enough with the softballs, please.
Okay, this is really hard.
Hey, little man. How you feeling?
Terrible.
Well, at least you feel the way you look. Right? Am I right? No, I'm just joking. You're dark and handsome. If it's dark, you're handsome. Okay, I gotta go.
LOL. Oh, Amy, take notes.
Those were hack one-liners from the internet.
What?
The internet. You know, the thing you won't be on in 3 weeks?
Wow. Hey. Amy.
That's not the direction we're going in?
No.
He's ready for a laugh, but, you know, could you please make sure it's funny?
So that's a sketch from Inside Amy Schumer on Comedy Central. Amy Schumer is my guest. Amy, so we've established you've done roasts. How did you come up with the idea for that really weird take on a roast?
Oh, that wasn't my idea, that scene. That was one of the writers, Kyle Dunnigan. We were kind of talking about roasts and who you wouldn't want to roast, and he came in with that idea, and it really made us laugh. It's sort of like a little bit inside baseball with there's a lot of jokes for comedians in that scene, or even just that I would bring my headshot. Like, why would this kid want my headshot? And I wrote "Have a great summer" on it. Just such a dumb little joke throughout the scene. But people just think that comedy can work anywhere. A lot of times we'll be asked to do a fundraiser or, you know, something like that, or, oh, will you do stand-up at my friend's birthday? And it's just, it takes so much for a show to be produced well and for stand-up to be successful or a roast to be successful. But people just don't realize that. They're just like, oh, tell me a joke. Whenever someone says, oh, just tell me a joke, you learn the lesson over time to never do it. It never works. And this is like a scenario. The family, it's just people being like, oh, do your bit, roast our son. And they think it's just going to be hilarious. And then, but it's really kind of hard and too awkward. But then that the doctor walks in and is just doing jokes from basically a joke book and they're killing. That's a little inside baseball comedy because, you know, you'll be working on the road and a comedian will go up and just be doing the oldest jokes ever told and just the crowd will be dying laughing. And you're thinking, I cannot believe these people are laughing at this. These are the oldest jokes. He's stealing all of these. And then you'll go up and do some stuff that you think is really original and funny and they just stare at you.
Amy Schumer, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Amy Schumer speaking with Terry Gross last Tuesday. The first season of Schumer's Comedy Central series Inside Amy Schumer concludes Tuesday. You can find a link to one of her sketches on our website, freshair.npr.org. The Bling Ring is the new film from Sofia Coppola, who made Lost in Translation and Marie Antoinette. It's based on the real-life story of a group of Southern California teenagers who, in 2008 and 2009, began breaking into the homes of Los Angeles celebrities and stealing their so-called bling. Everything from designer clothing to watches and jewelry. Our critic at large, John Powers, says that their crime spree says a lot about our current cultural values.
We live in a world filled with crimes, but most of them don't have much to tell us. They're cases of mere stupidity, cruelty, or greed. But every now and then one comes along that invites larger thoughts about the culture. Think of the 1964 murder of Kitty Genovese, stabbed to death while nearly 40 witnesses heard her screams but didn't want to get involved. Or the 1974 kidnapping of Patty Hearst, which felt like the final mad curdling of the 60s political dream. Or the Ponzi scheming of Bernie Madoff, that hollow pillar of the community who came to personify the 2008 financial crisis. Such crimes felt emblematic. Of course, not every emblematic crime is heavy. Take Sofia Coppola's entertaining new film, The Bling Ring, about a posse of thieving teens from L.A.'s prosperous West Valley suburbs. It's a true story, but you could believe its plot was dreamed up by some witty professor of cultural studies who wanted to make a point about American consumerism and celebrity mania. Israel Broussard plays Mark, the new kid at school, who desperately wants to be cool. He becomes friends with Rebecca, that's Katie Chang, who's obsessed with fashion and celebrity. Brainy and amoral, Rebecca suggests that they break into the Hollywood home of one of her idols, Paris Hilton. They do, and they grab what they want from her laughably teeming closets. Soon, they and several friends, including a wannabe reality star Nikki, played by Emma Watson, are robbing the homes of other tabloid luminaries, Lindsay Lohan, Orlando Bloom, Audrina Partridge. Tracking their victims' movements on the internet, this so-called bling ring eventually grabs $3 million worth of designer clothes, Rolexes, Louis Vuitton luggage, and red-soled Labutans. We've come a long way from the days when the young created a counterculture or chafed at parental restrictions. In The Bling Ring, adult authority is so squishy that the kids might as well punch a blob of jello. Here, one of the mothers, played by Leslie Mann, tries to enlist her daughter and friends in a visualizing exercise about values.
Okay, so we are going to make vision boards about people who are demonstrating good character, like Angelina Jolie. So, what qualities do you guys admire about Angelina Jolie?
Her husband.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Anything else?
Her hot bod.
Okay. Okay, well, the hot bod is not a characteristic, but okay.
How long do we have to do this for?
We're going to do it until we finish, and then we're going to move on to the fluorescence work.
If you're older than about, 19, you may spend the bling ring wanting to break into a chorus of, "What's the matter with kids today?" The bling ringers don't merely have a sense of entitlement the size of a stretch Hummer. They have all the moral intelligence of a vacuum cleaner. More feckless than sinister, they boast about their crimes, parade around in their loot, even post pictures on Facebook, which helps get them caught. Now, Coppola is no incisive social analyst, but her movie does get you thinking about the society that could produce the bling ring. After all, its young robbers aren't that far out of the American mainstream. Indeed, they're an almost natural offshoot of a consumption-crazy culture that incessantly celebrates the idea of owning fancy cars, fancy watches, fancy clothes. They're driven by the same heedless desire to live large that led grown-ups to run up vast, unpayable credit card bills, or to make millions selling off shares in worthless mortgages. Their enthrallment by celebrity is mainstream, too, endlessly reinforced by a 24/7 media that keeps pretending that nobodies are stars. In the past, to be famous, you had to do something. You know, have a hit song or win Wimbledon. Now you simply have to grab attention or possess the signifiers of fame. If you dress like Paris Hilton, you can be like her. So why not steal her clothes and wear them to the same club she'd go to? This isn't to excuse the bling ring's crimes, of course. Hundreds of other kids went to that same high school and managed not to be crooks or worshippers of Lindsay Lohan. And at the other end of the spectrum, countless other young people joined Occupy Wall Street to change the world. They wanted to narrow the gap between the privileged few and the vast majority who are made to feel like powerless losers. Not so the bling ring, whose members clearly see that same gap, but are blissfully untroubled by anything resembling idealism. Far from wanting to make a better world, they embrace much of what's shallowest in this one and are willing to break the law to get their share. Talk about rebels without a cause.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, in for Terry Gross. Being an African in America doesn't necessarily mean you know what it's like to be an African American. That's one of the things our next guest learned when she came to the U.S. from Nigeria to attend college. She found white and black people projecting things on her she didn't understand, and she was confused by the coded language that was often used to talk about race. She didn't get it then, but eventually she did. Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie has written a new novel based on her experiences coming to America, called Americana. Our book critic, Maureen Corrigan, described it as a big knockout of a novel about immigration, American dreams, the power of first love, and the shifting meanings of skin color. Terry spoke with Adichie last Thursday.
Chimamanda Adichie, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like to start with a reading from your book, and since your character blogs a lot, let's start with one of her blog posts. So if you could read the title of the post and the post.
So this post is titled, "To My Fellow Non-American Blacks, In America, You Are Black, Baby." Dear non-American black, when you make the choice to come to America, you become black. Stop arguing. Stop saying, "I'm Jamaican," or "I'm Ghanaian." America doesn't care. So what if you weren't black in your country? You're in America now. We all have our moments of initiation into the society of former Negroes. Mine was in a class in undergrad when I was asked to give the black perspective, only I had no idea what that was. So I just made something up. And admit it, you say, "I'm not black," only because you know black is at the bottom of America's race ladder. And you want none of that. Don't deny now. What if being black had all the privileges of being white? Would you still say, "Don't call me black, I'm from Trinidad"? I didn't think so. So, you're black, baby. And here's the deal with becoming black. You must show that you are offended when such words as watermelon or tar baby are used in jokes, even if you don't know what the hell is being talked about. And since you're a non-American black, the chances are that you won't know. In undergrad, a white classmate asks if I like watermelon. I say yes. And another classmate says, "Oh my God, that is so racist." And I'm confused. Wait, how? You must nod back when a black person nods at you in a heavily white area. It is called the black nod. It is a way for black people to say, "You're not alone, I'm here too." In describing black women you admire, always use the word strong, because that is what black women are supposed to be in America. If you're a woman, please do not speak your mind, as you're used to doing in your country. Because in America, strong-minded black women are scary. And if you're a man, be hyper-mellow. Never get too excited, or somebody will worry that you're about to pull a gun. When you watch television and hear that a racist slur was used, you must immediately become offended. Even though you're thinking, "But why wouldn't they tell me exactly what was said?" Even though you would like to be able to decide for yourself how offended to be, or whether to be offended at all, you must nevertheless be very offended.
And that's a reading from Chimamanda Adichie's new book, Americana. So... it's a great passage. You weren't defined by race when you were in Nigeria. Everyone around you was black. So how do things change when you were seen as black after coming to America? And knowing here that you were defined by race, that race is the big divide in America.
I like to think of it as something of a journey for me. I remember when I first came to the U.S., I really didn't consciously think of myself as black because I didn't have to. I thought of myself as Igbo, which is my ethnicity. And then in the U.S., there was a moment when I had just arrived and I was in Brooklyn, and this African-American man called me sister. And I remember reacting almost viscerally and thinking, "No, I am not your sister." And then I think also at the time I had very quickly absorbed all the negative stereotypes of blackness in America. And so I didn't want to associate myself with that. And I also remember in undergrad when a professor of mine came into class and said, "Who is Adichie?" Because this person called Adichie, which is the way Americans often pronounce my last name, had written the best essay in class. And I remember raising my hand, and for a fleeting moment there was surprise on his face. And I realized that the person who wrote the best essay wasn't supposed to look like me.
Do you feel like assumptions change about you when a white person or a black person finds out that you're from Nigeria and not born in the U.S.?
Yes, yes. I think that when I open my mouth and talk, and obviously everybody knows I don't have an American accent, in general, I have been told such things as, you're different, or you're not angry, or you don't have issues, that sort of thing. So there's sort of the assumption. I think there's a kind of, it's a strange thing and it's complicated, but there's a certain privilege to not being African-American in certain circles in the U.S., being black but not African-American.
What is the privilege and why do you think there is a sense of privilege?
I think that one isn't burdened by America's terrible racial history. And I think that when people say to me, you're different and you're not angry, in some ways it's that I also feel that I'm being made complicit in something that I don't want to be complicit in, because in some ways they're saying you're one of the good ones. And I think to say that is to somehow ignore, you know, the reality of American history. And so, for example, people will say, oh, you're so easy to get along with. And then they'll tell me a story about some African-American woman they knew who just wasn't like me. And, you know, which I find quite absurd. But yes, I think the honest, if we're honest about it, there's a certain privilege to being black but not African-American.
I think for white people, too, there's this burden of guilt that's lifted. Mm-hmm. Because I think there is a sense of kind of collective guilt that white people carry for enslaving African Americans. And so if your ancestors were never brought to the U.S. and enslaved, poof, in this relationship, you're relieved of that guilt.
Yeah. I think that is true. I mean, I think that the part of my life where I feel that guilt, because I feel a certain amount of class guilt. I think I occupy a space of privilege when it comes to class. And I know, for example, that when I'm back in Nigeria, I feel class guilt. And I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. I do think it can get in the way of honest conversations. So I realize that there's white guilt in the U.S., but I don't think it's very helpful. I don't know if that makes sense. I mean, I think that maybe what American blacks and American whites should take away from the table is the idea of personal responsibility.
What do you mean by personal responsibility?
I think that sometimes white Americans think, to start off, they say things like, well, it's not my fault, I didn't do anything. And I just feel like, of course it isn't your fault, right? It's not, but the fact that white Americans benefit from a history that gives them white privilege doesn't mean that it's somehow their fault. They didn't ask to be born white. I mean, so in the novel, for example, Ifemelu, who's the main character, goes to work for a white woman. And this white woman is very well-meaning, and she just is so uncomfortable about race that she won't say black. So if she wants to talk about black people, she says beautiful. So she'll say to Ifemelu, oh, I'm going to go see my beautiful co-worker, or I have this beautiful woman that I met at the store. And it turned out that every time Ifemelu actually did end up seeing these people, they were not particularly beautiful, but they were just black. And so Ifemelu says to her, you know, you can actually just say black. And for Ifemelu, it's the beginning of a friendship. That's the point where she imagines that this woman is her friend, because that's for her when she thinks that they can actually talk honestly about things. Because, you know, not all black people are beautiful, and so it's actually okay to say black.
In the blog post reading that your character does from your novel Americana, your main character, who's Nigerian after coming to America, finds herself in the middle of these, like, landmines about language and stuff that she doesn't really understand, because she's not schooled in America's race conflicts. Did that happen to you? Did you find yourself in the middle of conversations where you didn't really understand the subtext, so you had no idea why somebody was angry or how you were supposed to respond?
Yes, I did initially. I mean, now, of course, having read quite a bit about African-American history, and I know now, but initially I didn't. And I remember, for example, and I use this in the book, a conversation in my undergrad class about watermelon. And an African-American classmate was very annoyed because she said that somebody else in class had said something to her about watermelons. And I remember sitting there thinking, but what's so bad about watermelons? Because I quite like watermelons. And just really being confused, and also feeling that the African-American woman was annoyed with me because she thought I should get it and that I should share in her rage. And it was such a strange moment because looking back now, I realize that race is such a strange construct because you have to learn what it means to be black in America. So you have to learn that watermelon is supposed to be offensive.
So much of America's history and America's racial tensions have to do with slavery. You really can't understand America without understanding the history of slavery in America. And you're from Nigeria, which was the place that a lot of Africans were kidnapped from, so as to be taken to the United States to become slaves. And I'm wondering, like, was the slave trade a part of what you learned about in school when you were growing up?
Mm-mm. Not really, no. I really don't think that in general, and of course I'm generalizing, but I don't think there's a very strong sense of the magnitude and the horror that the transatlantic slave trade was for people of my generation in Nigeria, and I'm probably going to say in most of the African continent, which I think is also why many Nigerians don't really get it, to put it simply, no.
You were born in a town called Nsukka, am I saying that right?
Nsukka. So the N is hummed.
Yes, Nsukka. And that's the place where the University of Nigeria is.
Yes.
Your parents were both affiliated with the university. Growing up in Nigeria, race obviously wasn't the defining trait of who your friend or who your enemy was or the history of conflict or anything, but ethnic identity really mattered a lot. Your family is Igbo, and correct me if I'm wrong, in the Biafran War, your town was a part of the breakaway state of Biafra, but it was captured early in the war by Nigerian forces. So what did that war mean in the life of your family?
My family was deeply affected by it. I like to say that my parents' generation lost their innocence in that war. My father lost everything he owned, every material thing he owned. He also lost his father, who died in a refugee camp. My mother lost her father. My parents had just come back from the U.S. months before the war started. My father was eager to get his degree and go back to Nigeria because he was part of that generation who very much wanted to build up their countries. And he gets back to Nigeria. He starts teaching at the University of Nigeria. And then months later, this war starts. And he tells just so many moving stories, many of which are used in my second novel. And I think the memory is still very much there for him and for his generation. When I started researching the novel that set around that period, I realized that talking to them was really when they would tell me about it, was the first time that they had actually really talked about many of the things that happened. And my father tells a story about his father dying in a refugee camp, and his father was a titled man in Igbo land, which meant that, you know, he was a great man. He had one of the highest titles that a man could have. But his hometown fell, so he had to leave and go to a refugee camp, and he died, and he was buried in a mass grave, which, you know, is just heartbreaking for a man, particularly a man like him. And my father, who is the first son and who takes his responsibilities very seriously, very much wanted, he couldn't go to bury his father because the roads were occupied. He was in a different part of Biafra, and so it took a year until the war ended. Then he could go to the refugee camp. And he says the first thing he wanted to do when the war ended was go to the refugee camp. And he goes there and he says, you know, I want to know where my father was buried. And he said somebody waved very vaguely and said, oh, we buried the people there. So it was a mass grave because so many people had died. And my father says that he went there and he took a handful of sand. And he says he's kept the sand ever since. And for me, that was one of the most moving things that I'd ever heard, and it said so much to me about my father, who's such a lovely, gentle, quiet, stoic man. And I just hadn't imagined that my father would be a man to take a handful of sand and to keep it, and what that meant and the symbolism of it. And also I think that story just says so much about what the war did to them, not just in the way that they lost material things, but in the way that they lost emotionally.
I'd like you to explain the title of your book, Americana. You might spell it for us first, and tell us if you feel like you are perceived as being an Americana, or if you see yourself that way.
So Americana, which is America, and then with two extra letters, A and H at the end, It's actually a Nigerian word. So it's a kind of playful word that's used for people who have been to the U.S. and who come back to Nigeria with American affectations, or who go to the U.S. and come back and pretend that they no longer understand Igbo or Yoruba or Hausa, or who come back to Nigeria from the U.S. and, you know, suddenly won't eat Nigerian food, and everything is about when I was in America. And also often it's used for people who are genuinely Americanized, but it's a very playful way of, it's often used in the context of a kind of gentle mockery. And I don't think of myself as Americana. I think partly because I was fortunate enough to go back to Nigeria after only 4 years in the U.S., unlike some people who just can't get to go back. Like the character in the novel, she doesn't go back for 13 years. And when she goes back, she's really changed. And Nigeria has also changed. But I went back after 4 years. And even then, it had changed. But there are times when my friends tease me about such things as going to a restaurant in Lagos and ordering steamed vegetables.
Is that so weird?
Because they say to me, so sometimes when we're getting there at the restaurant, and my friend, this, particularly my friend Choma, who's this lovely woman who lives in Lagos, and she'll turn to me and say, do not ask for steamed vegetables today. They don't do steamed vegetables. That is an American thing. Because, you know, vegetables are often drenched in oil or the, you know, sort something. And I did have my phase of slightly American eating issues when I would sort of say, I don't want any oil, or I would say things like, what kind of oil is that? And then my friends would say, please just stop being so American. Or when I would complain about people smoking in public places, and they would just shake their heads and say, how American. So little things of that sort. But I think that in general, but on the other hand, some of my cousins are very disappointed at my still remaining resolutely Nigerian. So when I go to my ancestral hometown, I don't speak a word of English. I will speak only Igbo. And my cousins are so disappointed, particularly that I don't have an American accent. They're very unhappy about that.
Okay. I want to thank you so much for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Chimamanda Adichie speaking with Terry Gross last Thursday. Adichie's new novel is called Americana. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Fred Snyder. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Nell Beschenstein is our associate producer for online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.